is a good time to ask, going all the way back to Mandarin.
So is UV IR mixing the reason why it seems that there is no background independent formulation of strings?
I don't know. I mean, I would say that in perturbation theory, how can I say this properly? In perturbation theory, by definition, perturbation theory is perturbation theory around the background. But the classical equations of motion, in a sense, are independent of the background, in the sense that at least formally you can find, I mean, at least you can hope to find solutions which describe other backgrounds. We really only know how to do that for open strings in the moment. But at least conceptually it's not clear that, you know, at least infinitesimally it's true. Well, that we'll review momentarily later this week, that you can find sort of a classical solution of string of your string theory, which describes a nearby background. Then, when you go into non-perturbative completions, right? Then the only way I can know how to do that is going to holography, and then holography definitely has a partial background dependence. Holography depends on the choice of asymptotic structure of space-time, but does not select an actual shape of space-time away from the asymptotic part. So, in principle, you should be able to find, you know, multiple space-times with the same boundary inside the holography answers. Of course, inside the holography answers, you find a lot of other things, like maybe the same space-time with multiple d-brains stretching from the boundary all the way in. And I think it's not quite clear. See, there is this coupling, right? G string, which is roughly 1 over n in holography. If I start from the ground and add a D brain, this is going to be an effect of order e to the 1 over g. And I can add a whole bunch of these D brains. So that's already a non perturbative thing that I need to sort of understand. And looking at different shapes of space-time, that will be an e to the 1 over g squared, which is much smaller than the effects due to the d-brains. And so, to be honest, it's not clear to me if I'll ever get to talk about other space-times, or if d-brains will sort of modify the notion of space-time earlier than I need to worry about other space-times. This, I think, is a question of current research, in the sense that people try to do things like, OK, let's try to define just pure gravity and its holographic dual. Sometimes they have trouble finding holographic duals which are actual theories. So recently, most efforts are sort of producing theories of just gravity and nothing else, and that having duals which look like ensembles, statistical ensembles of theories, which I don't know, you can try to take in many ways, but the way I'm taking it is that perhaps, you know, deep brains and things like that matter. And, you know, are things that you should worry about before you get into multiple backgrounds or multiple space-times contributions. But I don't think I have a canonical answer to give. Other questions?
So last time when they are doing the tutorial on BRS decolonization of a point particle, they find two things are very interesting. The first is that you don't have to have same number of B ghosts and the C ghosts. That seems to be different from the Young Mills.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is that even if you impose the BRST, that the Q close over Q exact is actually not physical states. It also has some extra stuff that has extra ghost.
Mm-hmm. Meaning you need states that have ghosts inside, right? Yes. Right. So let's see. Is it always true that in your Mills you had the same number of soft Bs and C ghosts? I forget.
They call the B ghost the anti-ghost of C.
No, that's right. So the question is the kinetic term, does the kinetic term of the ghosts in Yamil's theory ever have zero modes? I would think it is still a thing that depends on the space-time you're in. I mean, let's do Chern-Simons theory, which is a little easier than Yamil's theory. In Chern-Simons theory, how does it work? In Chern-Simons theory, it's cute because you can package all the fields into a single object. So your gauge fields, which is a one form, there is the C ghost, which is a zero form. And then when you package things together, let's see. I think the anti-ghost is a three form. Well, I forget. Sorry. I don't think I can do it in real time. I guess one should ask, is the ghost number current? I mean, we are going to compute today the anomaly for the ghost number current, which tells you what's the difference in number of Bs and C ghosts in a path integral. I don't remember how the ghost number current is written in 4D, but right, one would have to ask, okay, does this ghost number current ever have an anomaly in 4D? Will the currents ever have anomalies in 4D? Sometimes, if you have chiral fermions. Or perhaps if you have self-dual forms that are charged under the current. I would say the standard gauge fixing on your Mills has neither, so I'd be ready to believe that there is no difference between the number of Bs and C ghosts in your Mills theory. But maybe if you have chiral fermions, that could be different. I'm not sure. I would have to. Well, they're not charged. So I think it's a matter of gauge fixing. I can imagine that there will be some crazy gauge fixing where this problem can occur, but probably the standard gauge fixing with the Lorentz gauge will not have that issue. That would be my guess. Maybe if you do some gauge fixing which in just in electromagnetism, you could imagine doing some gauge fixing which treats the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of the gauge field differently. That could probably give you an anomaly. And as for do we need to put the actual ghosts in the operators we build? I mean, the stress tensor is an example. The stress tensor in 4D has ghosts inside because it receives contributions on the ghosts. I do not know if the individual pieces of the stress tensor are BRST closed. My guess would be no. So I think operators in Yamil's, even in Yamil's theory, operators are likely to require contributions on the ghosts. And again, this is something we'll see. Concretely into the it's important to remember that a lot of the statements really might depend on your choice of gauge fixing. They are not universal. And always be cautious. In quantum field theory, almost no statement is independent. You know, the physics, of course, is independent of how you do your calculations, the scheme you use to do your calculations, to do your definitions, and so on. But everything else is always subject to all sorts of ambiguities, which cannot and should not be eliminated. So this sort of scheme dependence is always very important, and pretending it's not there is a recipe for disaster, typically. So whenever you do a quantum filtering calculation, and you can express the answer in terms of physical quantity and physical questions, that would be an ambiguous, but everything else is subject to variations depending on how you're doing your calculations. And gauge fixing is no exception. Okay, so string theory and ghosts. The note has a lot of technical details, which are not really needed, and I'm not going to discuss because we don't need them to understand what's going on. I'll try sort of to follow a simplified path to the story. So in particular, I will just pick a complex structure to start with and then walk in the complex structure. And yes, at some point, we'll have to think about the moduli space of complex structures, which means that I had to change the complex structure I've chosen. But in order to write a measure on the moduli space of complex structures, something I can integrate over it, I only need to understand things locally. So that's not so difficult. And I will do it later, maybe, or not. It's not really super important for our purposes. So if you pick a complex structure, it means that we can say things like, OK, I have the metric, and I write it in complex coordinates. Now I have hzz, hzz bar, and hz bar z bar. And can you guess? And now let me just try to do the first step of gauge fixing when we deal with diffeomorphisms. While invariance, it just sort of takes care of itself at the end. So we have this metric, and also we have diffeomorphisms, which are these transformations, which again we can write in complex coordinates. So these are our symmetries. And what are the constraints? Can you remember what constraints are we trying to impose on the metric? Which part of the metric are we going to kill using diffeomorphisms?
Diagonal
parts. That's right, which here is?
The HZZ. Yeah, the diagonal part
ZZZ
here.
Bar.
That's right. In complex coordinates, diagonal and off-diagonal look weird. So although it doesn't look like it, this is the off-diagonal part, and this is the off-diagonal part. So we want to set this to 0 and this to 0. And then this will give me a sort of a line element, which looks like HZZ bar, the Z bar. And then while symmetry is going to kill that, but let's not worry about that for now. OK, so these are the constraints, and these are the symmetries. And so they have, you know, cute little, you know, completely linear constraints, easy to impose. So for every constraint, you remember, we try to we introduce sort of an auxiliary field, perhaps, that we're going to put in our action so that when you integrate over B, it imposes the constraint. And then we need to have a little b, a b ghost, which will help us impose this constraint in the BRST formalism. And so we'll need the BZ. Pretty much you get a ghost for every component of the metric. So we're going to have something like a BZZ and a BZ bar Z bar. Actually, I think it would be useful to work with the inverse metric. So the ghost actually has two lower indices, slightly more convenient for various purposes. OK. So let me call just, I'll just call this B and this B bar. But let's remember that one of them has two holomorphic indices, and the other has two antihomomorphic indices. It's no coincidence. These are the sort of the same sort of indices we're putting in the stress tensor. And indeed, in the BRST formalism, the BRST variation of my antifield is the constraint I'm imposing. So this, the role of this B is just to make the constraint into something exact, which can be, which is effectively zero. So we'll get statements like this. So including the B ghost in the store is what allows to treat, to make the stress tensor unimportant, exact, too exact. On the other hand, every symmetry gives us a C ghost. And so we'll have some CZ, which I'm going to call C, some CZ bar. I'm going to call C bar. And the BRST variation of sort of the matter fields should be a gauge transformation with parameter C. So we saw how, so these are scalar fields on the worksheet, so they transform in the simplest possible way under the action of the vector field. The vector field translates them a little. And so the same thing happens here. So I just literally wrote this action, replacing V's with C's. So these are sort of the two pieces of the story. In the BRST formalism, both gauge transformations and constraints are in the image of Q, and so they drop out in correlation functions. Now, how do we write the action for the ghosts? Usually, to write the action of the ghost, you take the constraint and you act on it with the gauge transformation. And that sort of gives you the kinetic term for your ghosts. Here, if I were to act with, say, the V of Z transformation, then the metric will be rotated by the Jacobian. So there is sort of a dV, d bar V, d bar V bar matrix, which acts on H. So this sort of transformation will sort of shift H, Z bar, say, by something like H, Z, Z bar, sorry, let's look back. H, Z bar, D, Z bar, V, Z, plus stuff, del H, Z bar, stuff which is zero because it contains other H's. Okay. So the recipe to find the kinetic term is pretty much to replace V with C and then put a B in front of that. So the action for the ghosts is going to be essentially B, the bar C, Z bar. Sorry, let me put that bot plus B bar del C bar. Some of the choices I made here were made with 2020 hindsight, so that the thing I have here now has one Z index and one Z bar index down, which means that once I multiply by the Z bar, this is fine and nice without having to put metrics by hand. So we have the maximum for the ghosts, and here the action for the matter fields. And here too, you know, I have two indices down and two indices up. This is actually a manifestation of the fact that both of these actions are while invariant. I really don't need to put the metric when I define them, as long as they have a complex structure. I don't need to put HZZ bar never enters. So while symmetry is sort of dealt with automatically, everything is while invariant. And the constraint for while symmetry would come from while symmetry, which is that TZZ bar is zero, at least classically, is automatically true. So these are classically conformal field theories, and they satisfy this on the nose. We don't have to work hard to make it happen, it's just always true. So this is kind of our starting point. We have this action, we have X's, B's, and C's. And we want to have a Bresti symmetry, which at least classically acts like this. When I say classically, what I mean is that, you know, classically, the operators in my theory say are polynomials in the fields and their derivatives, and then the Bresti symmetry acts on each symbol one at a time using a Leibniz rule. Like if I want to ask what's a Q acting on BC, I just check what Q does on B or on C, and I add that up. That's like a derivative. Quantum mechanically, things become a little bit more subtle, and we'll discuss. Now I'm going to just write for you a current for this Bresti symmetry. Will I? I'll try at least. I'll probably get it wrong, but so. So I want to define, I want to just write down the action of this transformation. And I want to write it in a way that will allow me to sort of do quantization nicely. And in quantum field theory, whenever I have symmetry and things are reasonable, I should be able to get a current for it. Now, of course, you could say, OK, is this really a symmetry of this action? Well, it's a little bit of work to check. It's not too difficult. When you do variation here, you're going to get things like true X's and a C. When you do the variation here, this will have true X's, there will be a C. But actually, it will turn out that we need to have here the total stress tensor, not just the stress tensor of the X's. And so there will be an extra turn that looks like, I don't know, 1B and 2Cs. And then I didn't write down how Q acts on C, but that will make everything work. So there is something like QC is C del C. Pretty much the only thing that was available to write down. And again, if you've looked a bit at the Bresti formalism examples, you can see that typically Q of C is the product of two C's with a structure constant, which is the structure constant of your Lie algebra. For these vector fields, the Lie algebra is the Poisson is the Lie bracket of vector fields. And this is just that. Okay, so what is Q? So if I use the Noether theorem, I can write Q as the zero mode of a current. So let's do that. So I go from Q to a Bresti current, which looks like this. There is a C del X So it's going to have to come through components because it's a current. There is going to be a JZ and a JZ bar. They're going to be separately conserved, actually. So let me just write half of it. There's probably one half. I always forget. And again, there is a number here I always forget, which is some. And then there is a B, a C, del C. OK, you don't need expression very much, but just wanted to have it on the board. OK, so at least classically, this current is the current for that symmetry, and that symmetry squares to zero. Again, the fact that the symmetry squares to zero is not immediately obvious. Is it should follow from the whole formalism, but it can also be checked by hand. So when you act on C, for example, it follows on the fact that bracket over there satisfies the Jacobian identity. When you act on X, it follows on the fact that the diffeomorphisms have this algebra and so on. It's just a little bit of patience, but you can check it. And then you can say, OK, let me just take this action and quantize it and see if everything works. Now, a nice feature of two-dimensional conformal field theories is that there is a very natural way to quantize the action of a symmetry, which is you take your current, you, at least in free theories, notice that very nice thing. Everything here is still free. So this BC action is a free action. We can keep working with just free field theory. We don't have to worry about other things. And so quantum mechanically, you can just normal order your current, pretty much. I mean, normal order. You need to define this current in the same way as we were defining our stress tensor. You'll have to do some point splitting regularization. So quantum mechanically, your J is going to be a limit as S prime goes to S. And then you'll have to sort of figure out what to do in here. You only need to really split fields which are which have non-trivial divergences as they come together. So they sort of they're paired up in the action. So you had to do something like that, and then probably something like that. And then figure out what to subtract off. But you know, more or less what you did for the stress tensor, you can do it for this. And then once you have a well-defined local definition of your current, you can try to define your charge as just an integral of the current. Now, the whole thing will now work or not work, depending on a simple question. Is Q squared still zero? If Q squared is still zero, then you have quantized your gauge theory, your constraint system, or whatnot. If Q squared is not zero, then you have a Bayesian anomaly, and you're in trouble. And you need to try to fix it. If you can find a way to fix it, you can still keep going. And if not, you throw away the theory. So computing Q squared, it's a little bit of a pain. Much as if what we did with the Virzo algebra, what's really convenient to do is to compute the Q of G BRST. It still takes work. So I'm not going to do it. Just too much work. But very roughly, you find that a whole bunch of things cancel out, but there is unfortunately a number that can appear here. I hope it's this, I think it's correct. And this number, you had to compute it, and it happens to be the dimension of space-time n of 26. It's a straightforward, it's tedious calculation. There is actually a shortcut to get to this number, which is to do the following. You can check that Q of B is T, where T is sort of the sum of two terms. One is the stress tensor for the axis, and the other is the stress tensor for the ghost, which I'm going to write down momentarily. And in particular, so you can sort of, so you find on the right hand side, you find the modes of the Virasoro algebra if you expand out. So you can write down things like, okay, I decompose this in Fourier modes, and here I find the total modes of the Virasoro. And then you can check that this relation implies that the L's sort of satisfy the Virasoro algebra and not the centrally extended Virasoro algebra. Pretty much because you can act it L outside, and that gives you something like LNQ BN plus LM, sorry, Q LM BN. And well, this is zero because L's are in the image of Q. So if I act Q twice, I get zero. And this you can compute. There is essentially a B. It's something like M minus N B of N plus M, something like that. And so you get just to say that in practice, you see that something is going to be wrong if the L's have a central extension. So if you remember the algebra of the L's had this sort of term, and then there was something like some number over 12 n squared n minus 1. And so this number better be zero, otherwise it's the thing is inconsistent. So instead of doing this calculation, which is kind of tedious, today we are going to do this calculation. In a sense, it's a necessary condition for the whole thing to make sense, and then you can check with some more work that is actually sufficient too. That once this number here is the same as this number here, and is the only thing that could have gone wrong. Okay, I'm sorry. I just want to sort of, because clearly today we cannot do everything. I just want to sort of give an overview of the things that we need to do, sort of minimal things that we need to do to understand what's going on. So what we need to do is to understand roughly how this theory works. Understand how to define things like the stress tensor in this theory. And that would be enough, pretty much, to then move on to compute the string theory spectrum in a more refined way than we did last week. So, in a sense, we can now sort of forget our muscle was on this board. The only thing we care about is the action. So let me rewrite it. So that should, it's a funny action, right? Because sort of the this half and this half of the ghost don't really talk to each other. It's not like in the case of the scalar, where there was sort of a del and a del bar in the same action. So for the scalar field, the equations of motion were something like del del bar x equal to 0. But here the equations of motion are things like del bar c is 0, del bar b is 0, del c bar is 0, del b bar is 0. So the equations of motion are first order instead of being second order. And also, there are some fields which are just holomorphic classically, and some fields which are just anti-holomorphic classically. Some point later on, maybe we'll discuss the free fermion in 2D, which has similar features. So, what's the stress tensor? Well, if you just look at the action, you need a little bit of extra information to know what the stress tensor is. Not enough to write the action. You need to tell me how the field transform under conformal transformations, under rescaling of the coordinates, for example. So we need to remember that B was actually BZZ, and C was actually a CZ. Right? This means that if I change coordinates, I'm going to get transformations like that. Whatever stress tensor we write has to give you the infinitesimal version of these transformations when I build Virasoro generators and I act on modes. See, in order for the action to make sense, the only thing you really need is that I should have written it as Z, the Z bar. The only thing you really need is that this number, perhaps you should have written minus one here, sorry, that this number and this number add up to one, so that when the whole thing transforms as a form that you can integrate. Somehow, so the stress tensor looks like this. There is a C dsb, and there is a chu dcb. And notice I could also write this. These are fermions, so I could also write this minus dsbc. Okay. So this chu and this minus 1 are literally this chu and this minus 1. So this is the stress tensor for the ghosts. And when I write this expression, again, I would have to really point split to do a quantum mechanical definition. There is another quantity I want to write down, which is the ghost number current, not to be confused with BRST current. So the action has an obvious symmetry where C has charge 1 and B has charge minus 1. This is useful symmetry to keep track of how many C's and how many B's do I have in an expression. So in particular, to figure out also what are, you know, these issues about the mismatched numbers of B's and C's in correlation functions. So, and the current is extremely simple, just BC. Okay, so both these objects get some slight quantum subtleties from the point splitting procedure. And I would like to go over that. Let's start from the Gauss number current because it's a bit easier. So a better definition of the Gauss number current is limit as s goes to s prime of b of s, c of s prime. And then I need to figure out what to subtract. Now, looking at the equations of motion, can we figure out what the Green's function look like? So what should, you know, what do you think is the equation satisfied by this quantity?
Like del bar on this delta function.
That's right. So del bar of this becomes kind of an equation of motion, suppose I do with respect of s, becomes the equation of motion for b. B appears in the action paired up with C. So the sort of real, you know, remember the equation of motion fail at the location of other operators, the operators which are paired up with them in the Lagrangian. So the equation of motion for B fails at the location of C. And indeed, it fails by some number times a delta function. Do you know how to solve this sort of equation?
Represent the delta function as a...
What would you put in the right-hand side? Which singularity would I put on the right-hand side such that the bar of it is a delta function?
One over s minus.
That's right. So 1 over s minus s prime. Of course, I could have also just repeated what I did for the scalar field, and I will do so. Just I'm not sure I could do it in time. So expanding B and C's into Fourier modes, representing them as fermionic harmonic oscillators, writing down the two-point correlation function, and so on. This can all be done. I will do it. But just to say, you know, the sort of the sort of singularities which you encounter will look like that. And of course, you've done some CFT, so you could also use the language of OPEs. You could say the OPE of B and C is this. And so here I will subtract 1 over s minus s prime. Now, this is much simpler than what we had for the stress tensor. We had some derivatives and stuff. So I think it's a good example to see what happens to an operator defined like that if I change my coordinate system. So suppose that I write my s as some s of another coordinate. I call it z. So the original definition had a subtraction of 1 over s minus s prime. And the new definition has a subtraction of b of z, c of z prime, minus 1 over z minus z prime. So how do I relate these two? Probably keeping this in mind. Can you tell me how to rewrite this in terms of the z coordinates? What's b of s in terms of z coordinates? Yeah, that's right. That's right. So BFS, of course, I'm sure that I got it wrong. So BFS is the Z over DS squared V of Z. And then I have a factor from C. And then I'm subtracting 1 over S minus S prime, of course. Now, this I can almost rewrite like that. Except for the subtraction term. Okay. Right. So this is what might be getting us in trouble, the difference between these two terms. And so I would have to take the limit as z goes to z prime of this expression. Again, it's still complicated enough that I probably would want to use Mathematica to do this, although I don't really need. But the point I want to just make here is that if I compare J, the defining different coordinate systems, it doesn't quite transform as a current, but it gets a constant shift. So there are other ways to express this fact, but in complex coordinates, this is the more natural way. So that means when you sort of try to assemble your Riemann surface out of patches, what you thought was the value of the current in one patch becomes a different value somewhere else. If you try to sort of ensure that you have current conservation, charge conservation, for example, you had to manipulate sort of little, integrals of your current as you bring them around your surface. But as you bring them around, occasionally you had to shift the value of the current. And so at the end of the calculation, something was supposed to be sum of the charges equal to zero ends up sum of the charges equal to something. So this sort of anomaly means that if I have a correlation function of operators on some surface, the sum of the Gauss numbers of these operators is not zero, as would be the case if you have a symmetry, but it's just a very specific number, because the calculation you do to find this number only depends on the shifts. It knows nothing about the actual operators. So it's a number which only depends on the surface you're doing the calculation on. Now, in a sense, the number of B's minus the number of C's that you find that you need to put in a correlation function to get a non-zero answer is a property of the surface only. And with a little bit of patience, you can compute it. For example, you will find that on a sphere, the number of C's minus number of B's has to be 3. And statements like that. And we'll see manifestations to these facts concretely when you work doing calculations. Let's see. What else should I say? Yes. So you can also do a similar calculation to see the point splitting regularization of the stress tensor. And you can compute the, with some patience, the action of the ghost, the version of the Virasoro algebra for the modes of the ghost or the stress tensor for the ghosts. So again, as you remember, when we're doing calculations with the scalar fields, this sort of shifts in the point splitting regularization end up giving us a non-trivial central extension of the Virasoro algebra. And here I get something similar with a certain number. Except this number is minus 26. And it's not a mystical calculation, okay? It's just some tedious, just because there are two terms in the stress tensor, so you need to take both into account. It takes a little bit of work. It has some one square, some two squares, and things like that. And at the end, when the dust settles, you get a minus 26. So if you tell me what number is here, I can give you what number you have here. It's some quadratic expression. And when the number is 2, you get minus 26. And so when you combine the stress tensor for the Gauss and for the matter fields, then the anomaly, that number will be dimension minus 26 and will vanish for dimension 26. So this is sort of one of the two numbers which you could not get out of doing things by hand last week. Somebody had to tell us that the correct dimension was 26. And here you can derive it. There is another number which will appear when we study the Hilbert space for the ghosts. And I think we have enough time to discuss it. So now I'm going a bit fast today, probably. I just want to get the ghosts out of the way and get into concrete calculations. Because at the end, to be frank, the only time we'll ever encounter the ghosts is when we try to compute this correlation function on a sphere with three ghosts. And I'll just tell you, OK, this is one, and let's move on. Well, not one really, but okay, something. But nevertheless, there is some physics in knowing what's going on about the ghosts, and I don't want to completely disregard it. So, Fourier expansion. Same thing as we did for the scalar field. Except that because this is holomorphic fields, I only need to include S's. And then there will be the B bar and the C bar, which will have their expansion using S bar. So we need to figure out what are the commutation relationships of these modes. It's not difficult to derive them from the action. You find that sort of B's anti-commuted B's, C's anti-commuted C's, and the only non-trivial ones are between B's and C's. So because somehow the action involves pairs up B and C, you end up having them paired up in the Poisson brackets too. So now I want to build sort of the Hilbert space for these modes. Now these are fermionic modes instead of bosonic modes, the anti-commute instead of commuting. They square to zero in particular. So starting from a ground state, I only ever have to act, I can act at most once with the creation operator. Furthermore, there are no zero modes. You know, there was this X and P in the scalar field. There is nothing like that here. I mean, there is still some zero. There are still constant terms in here. There is a B0 and a C0. But, you know, they're very easy to quantize. They're not different from the other modes. The main difference is that for the scalar field, remember, there was an N here. So the zero mode was special. Here, there is no N. All the modes are equally nice. So we have some ground state. I call it G because sometimes zero is used for something else in this context. And then I can create excitations on this ground state. So this ground state, by definition, is going to be killed by all creation operators. Right, I need to be careful. So all the things that raise, lower the energy will have to kill it, is the ground state. Now, what about the, I still need to say something about the zero modes. The zero modes don't raise or lower the energy. I have a B0 and a C0, which I'm to commute to 1 and square to 0. The fact that they square to 0 means that if I have any state, right, I could act with C0 once, and I get something that then is killed by C0. Or I could act with B0 once, and I get something that is killed by B0. So without loss of generality, I could assume that, say, this is killed by B0. And then I'll have a second state, which is C0 acting on it. And let me just focus on the Bs and Cs. I'll have to say the same words about the B bars and C bars, but you know, they're separate. So I had two states which have the same energy, G and C0G. And you know, if I act with C0 with B0, I go one way. And I act with C0, I go the other way. And then I can act with any number of Bs and Cs with negative indices. So that's the Fock space, not the ghosts. Now, as you remember, I say this properly. Once I define my stress tensor properly with point splitting and everything else, my ground state will have a very specific energy, the Casimir energy. And we could totally compute it now. But let me just delay for a second. So first, can't say. No, actually, it's fine. There's a point that I'll discuss later when I do state operator map. Right, I guess the only point I wanted to make is that I define some brass, some kits. I should also define some brass. So I could define a sort of dual state like that. But because of the way the problem is set up, if I use this definition, then G tilde will be annihilated by C0 instead of being annihilated by B0. Sorry. Yes. Right. Pretty much because I'm trying to build a state which is dual to this ground state. So I want it to be orthogonal to the other one. And so it's going to be killed by C0. So it's a bit more symmetric to define a G which is killed by B0. And then the inner product, which is nice, is between G, C0, they put also C0 bar G equal to 1. So that's one of the things I want to get to. So if you want to treat sort of the past and the future symmetrically, you kind of had to put some C's in there by hand. Should I be surprised by that? Well, let's look at the metric of a cylinder. Can you find any diffeomorphisms which leave this metric invariant? Any coordinate transformations which are symmetries to the cylinder? Rotations and translations. There's ds and ds bar with one here. These are precisely the ones that correspond to these ghosts. These are the zero modes. These are zero modes of vector fields. These are zero modes of the ghosts. So this is just the toy manifestation of the fact that whenever I have an unfixed gauge symmetry, I need to put by hand the corresponding ghosts in the path integral. Meaning it here, with a natural choice of states in the past and the future, I need to put by hand these ghosts. So if you sort of try to parse a little bit what's the meaning of saying that this is killed by B or C or whatnot, we could discuss that. But it's pretty much you're picking some boundary conditions here where you're not trying to kill this symmetry by hand. You're letting it be. And then you'll kill it in the correlation functions. A state like that instead is a state where you say, haha, I put boundary conditions on my fields or my symmetries or metric or whatever that forbid translation as a symmetry in the past, say. And then, okay, if I use that or in the future, this G tilde is something that sort of I put some boundary conditions that forbid the translations as a symmetry in the future. And then if I forbid it in the future, it's not there. And then I can just write things like that. But it's not a good idea because if I want to treat future and past symmetrically, I would have to forbid it both in the future and in the past. And forbidding something twice is a very bad idea usually because you're over-constraining. If you're over-constraining, it means you need Bs. And indeed, you have to do something like that. Now you can over-constrain, but put some forgiveness by adding a couple of Bs in there. So, choices. No choice is particularly canonical with respect to the other. They're just very concrete things you're doing. anyway, so using this data, we'll be able to do pretty much everything that we want. So it will turn out that this G is particularly convenient because a lot of interesting string states will be built out of G by acting with matter oscillators. Gtilde also plays a role, but it's a little bit more subtle. Okay, any final questions? Sorry again if this was a bit compressed. I did squeeze two of the lectures on the notes into one. But you know, I want to stress, even if you don't feel you understood anything here, it's not a big deal, because we will use it very sparingly, and then when you need it, you can learn it better.